Okay, I think we might begin now. All the important people are in. And usually if I say things like that, somebody walks in and they hear me and they go, oops, da-da-da-da-da, someone just come in. No. So for this morning's talk, to carry on with insights, and I don't know, maybe I'll try this one today, because people did say, can we have a deeper talk? Do you want a deeper talk today? Really? Well, this is the first example of deep talks, because what you want is usually what you don't get. Well, we'll give it a try and see how it works. Because one of the points in that question last night, which, you know, I was interested in, you know, was that, you know, who's managing all of this? Who's organizing it? Who's in charge? And that's always an important question to find answers for. But just to give a talk on a subject like that is not as easy as you think. Even if you know all the answers, just conveying it to people is very difficult, because a few times I've been asked to give a very deep talk, and I start off talking deeply, but then it just goes into just an ordinary, easygoing life advice sort of talks. And I often wondered in the early days why. And it is because, you know, I'd never talk at you, I always talk with you. And what that means is that it's up to you also to decide just how deep the talk will go, or just how shallow it will go. I talk with an audience, I never talk at them or to them. And I found that sometimes in some groups you've got some very good practitioners, and then I can give a very deep talk, it's easy to do. But if there is practitioners who aren't so advanced, haven't got so much experience, no matter how much I try to, I can't. And I always realize it's nothing to do with me, but everything to do with you. And me as well, obviously. You know, they're all of us together. And that was, you know, the way that whenever you are communicating, whenever you are relating to anybody or to anything, there is another dynamic which is important. And to understand that dynamic, I'm going back to just ordinary life now, but it was a very wonderful insight, and it led to so many different angles where you could find out some of the problems you face in life, overcome those problems in life, and create a better world for yourselves and for others. And that was, you know, the times when you go and do marriage blessings. It always concerned me that what is a monk doing blessing a marriage? What does a monk know about no marriages? But nevertheless, you are asked to go there again and again and again and again. You get quite popular doing blessings. And of course, there's, you know, so many different types of stories which you say at blessings. But if you haven't heard this one yet, this is one which I'm really famous for. It's called The Chicken and the Duck. A few of you remember this. But it was a couple who were just married. And one afternoon, after lunch, they went for a walk in the local parks or gardens. And as they were walking, they heard this sound. Quack, quack. Quack, quack. And she looked at her husband and said, "Oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken." And he said, "Pardon?" "So that's a chicken." He went, "Quack, quack." Again, he said, "Look, darling, that's not a chicken. That's a duck. It's a duck." He said, "No, no, no, I'm sure it's a chicken." He said, "It can't be a chicken. It went quack, quack, it's a duck." He said, "No, I'm sure it's a chicken." It went quack, quack again. He said, "Look, that's a duck. It's a duck, darling, a duck. D-U-C-K, duck, okay?" He said, "No, it's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck." She said, "It's a chicken." He said, "It's a duck." And because he was bigger and louder, she started to cry. Cedric. And then he remembered why he married her and what was really important in life. She was about to burst into tears. He looked her in the eyes, squeezed her hand very gently, and said, "Darling, I think you may be right. I think that is a chicken." He went quack, 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 quack again. "Yeah, it's a chicken." He said, "Thank you, darling." And they carried on their walk in peace and harmony. And he had a hot dinner that night. Now, in that version of the story, the husband was really smart. Who was right, who was wrong? The husband was right. For two reasons. First of all, is it really important that it's a duck or a chicken? Is that really worth getting divorced over? How many of you have these stupid arguments over stupid things which aren't really important? So first of all, he had his priorities right. His love, his relationship, his peace was more important than being right. Right took second place. And also, number two, it's just because it goes quack, quack, it does not necessarily mean that that's a duck. When I first told that story, I imagined it was a chicken. It was a chicken from Fukushima nuclear disaster zone, which had been mutated by excess levels of radiation to go quack, quack. But I found even a better story, because I've been telling that for such a long time, that somebody sent an email they've got on the internet somewhere, and there is at least one chicken who goes quack, quack. It was, as you could expect, it was an orphan chicken, and it got adopted by a mother duck, and with her other little babies, little ducklings, the little chicklet, whatever you call it, would go in line with all the other ducklings. And because the other ducklings went quack, quack, the chicken went quack, quack too. It learned how to go quack, quack. So there is at least one chicken in this world who goes quack, quack. It could have been it, who knows? So the second part of that story is, why do we have arguments? We always think we're right, but sometimes we're not right. Sometimes, even though it goes quack, quack, it's not a duck. So because of that, that's one of the reasons why that the wisdom we get of learning how to live in peace and harmony, not just with people, but with all of the aches and the pains, the ages, the illnesses, the sickness in your body, and also all the stuff which goes on in your mind, to be at peace with it. There was a basis of that story, I don't usually link this up, it's a basis of that story when I told people, if you do see nimittas, is it a nimitta? It can't be a nimitta. Give it the benefit of the doubt. Just because it goes quack, quack, doesn't mean it's a duck. It could be a chicken. It could be a nimitta. Give yourself that confidence and the trust. And you find a lot of time, especially in the meditation, you go far deeper, much quicker, simply because you have a positive mind state. Not always doubting and seeing the mistakes, but seeing the good things in it. So you start to see that here, what I do when I give talks like that, or examples like that, I am actually brainwashing you. Reconditioning you, giving you another way to look at life. And I freely admit that. I am influencing you. And because I do, you have happier lives. And I still recall this Malaysian girl. We were doing some fundraiser for some one of our projects years ago, and she was working so hard all day on the fundraising dinner or lunch or whatever it was. And at the end, I sort of went and said, "Thank you so much." And "No, no, no, please, you don't have to thank me. I have to thank you. You know, you did the blessing for our marriage about 8-9 months ago. I never had the chance, but I'll tell you now what happened." that after our marriage, that was the one story which really stood out, the chicken and the duck story. And then every now and again, just, you know, we had an argument, or we should have had an argument in our house. Something was wrong, and I stood in front of my husband, you know, the young husband, and said this and said that, and the husband would just look at me and say, okay, do it that way. Or, okay, do it your way. Or, yeah, you're right. And after a while, that got so frustrating. You know, he wasn't, like, engaging, you know, in our relationship. And so she said to me, I confronted him one day. Why don't you argue with me? Why don't we discuss things, you know, deeply? And she told me, said he looked me in the eyes and said, chicken, duck, quack, quack. And she said that was the last argument they had. It wasn't really an argument at all. Because she realized as how her husband had also listened to that story, really appreciated it. And it had saved the early years of their marriage when they're getting used to one another. And so I thought, wow, what a wonderful story that is, that chicken and duck story. And how it does mean we don't argue with life. We actually just make peace with our life. Someone doesn't come up to do the chores in the morning, which are supposed to be sharing for you, so you do their chores as well. You get upset and angry, they've let you down. They haven't let you down. Who knows, they may be in jhanas. You say, yay, she's in jhanas. I'll do all the dishes for you. Whatever it is, you can always look at the positive side of things. And when you do, you don't have this terrible bad will, bad thoughts, anger, all that stuff which eats you up from inside out. And it means you can't get deep meditation when you think of that blah, 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 diddle, blah, 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 blah. And then you start thinking. You start thinking, we should, it's a good idea, maybe we should have a blacklist here. And so anyone who bangs the doors, or just makes too much noise, who doesn't turn up for their duties, who doesn't do this, who doesn't do that, they should be put down on a list and give it to Ajahn Brahm. And so we make sure they never, ever, although even the worst ones, have you got anyone in your cottage who snores? Oh, this was a funny story because I could visualize it. Just, it was years ago, I was teaching meditation in a prison. And in the prison, it was top security, so there's some really dangerous people in there. And so you always had to have a prison officer with you during the meditation at all times. So I started my meditation group. Okay, sit down. Just close your eyes. Prison officer, you don't need to. You can just sit down and relax. You know, just sit down, close your eyes and relax the body. You know, relax the mind, watch the breath, all that stuff. And then I heard somebody snoring. And I opened my eyes. And it was the prison officer. He was fast asleep. And one of my disciples, he had his eyes open as well. And his hand was almost at the keys on the prison officer's belt. And he looked at me, and I looked at him. Five more seconds and I'd have got those keys. But those prisoners were scallywags. That's what they were doing in there, I suppose. But anyway. But they were always really good because after I said, okay, just don't tell anybody, okay, I won't tell, but don't do it again, okay. So anyway, but the main one I wanted to, story which I told during weddings, which was really important, which is actually about, you know, your learning how to have harmony and peace in your meditation practice. So you're not fighting a war of conquest. You're doing far better than that. When you fight a war to try and beat something, destroy defilements or hindrances or anything else which is a problem in your meditation practice, you are controlling it. You're actually making the sense of ego and self stronger and stronger, and you'll find the problems will keep on coming up. They will never finish that way. But there is an alternative. And that was when usually after the rings are exchanged in marriages. After they're exchanged, then I usually give the advice on how to stay married, how to stay in harmony and peace together. And so I first of all look at the bride, look her straight in the eyes. I'm a monk now, so I'm not afraid of relationships or anything, way past that stage. So I look her in the eyes and say, "You are now a married woman. From today on, you mustn't think of yourself." And she always nods sweetly and looks at her darling husband. And then I look at the husband and say, "You two are now a married man. You must not think of yourself from this day on." He nods. But the husband in Australia always pauses first of all. He considers it. But then he always gives it. Okay, yes. And then still looking at the husband, I say to him, "And from this day on, now you're a married man, you must not think of your wife." I look at the wife. "And the same with you, from this day on, you must not think of him, your new husband." And I love those moments where people try to figure out what the hell I'm talking about. "What are you supposed to say? But we're in love, of course I'm going to think about it." I said, "No, don't." So, because in a relationship, you must never think of yourself. That's selfishness. What type of relationship is that? If you think of your partner, you'll get burnt out. There's nothing in it for you. So there is a wonderful third option. It's not about me. It's not about you. It's about us. So don't think of your partner. Don't think of yourself. Only think of us. You're in it together. And they get, "Oh, yeah." So if there's any trouble in the relationship, whose trouble is it? Our problem. Not his problem, not her problem, not my problem, but our problem. In other words, you come together and fix problems. Rather than thinking it's his problem, it's her problem, it's... I don't know if you heard about the wife, she was spending way too much money on the credit cards, but even so, the husband was so nice, he gave her plastic surgery during the holiday season. You know what plastic surgery means? Cut up the credit cards. Okay, I won't go there any longer. But sometimes we use wisdom to train our mind, to see things in a slightly different way. That is called insight. It's insight which may feel like funny, jovial, seeing things in a new way, but my goodness, it really works. So even if it's in a community where you're working, just your whole little group in the office, the people who work for you, the people who you work for, you don't think about yourself. It has to be about us if you really, really want to get somewhere in life. Of course, I'm supposed to be the manager of the Bodhinyana Monastery over the road. I'm the boss, the abbot, really senior. But it doesn't mean I just think of myself. It doesn't mean I just sacrifice myself for the others. It's almost as if you look at the whole community being us. We're in it together. So if I succeed, you succeed. If I fail, you fail. If you fail, I fail. That way, when we look at it as us, you get far better results. And also, that's what I do with my meditation, my body and my mind. And also you as well here. Because I know that if you have good meditation, then I have good meditation. If I have good meditation, your meditation improves. Because there is going to be a connection there. You can't avoid that. There was the old story, and one of the books, the Good Bad Who Knows book, when it goes to different countries, it gets different titles. But the Good Bad Who Knows book, that was translated in Germany, where it did really, really well. It won it on the bestseller list there. and that they called that not the good bad who knows, they called it by the title of another story, The Elephant That Lost Its Happiness. It's very good if you have titles, even like really deep books, to give them like kids' titles. It actually pushes up the sales. You try it. So the people in Germany were really smart. So the Elephant Which Lost Its Happiness story is this. There was an elephant, king's elephant, a long time ago, very well behaved, very strong, always willing to do what the king wanted the elephant to do, to drive, go here, go there, really reliable. In those days in the jungles, in the forest, the elephant was like the car, and this was like sort of a Rolls Royce, Mercedes, just all stuck into one. It was a brilliant elephant. But then, for no reason, the elephant started to misbehave. So, you know, when it was drinking water, it would suck up some in the trunk and even squirt the king. And sometimes it would wait, even though it needed to evacuate its backside to do what we call like a number two. It would always wait until the elephant trainer was right behind it, and then it would poo. And that's a lot of poo from an elephant. So it can make him like a bad elephant for no reason whatsoever, just being just nasty-minded. And the king couldn't understand why. He'd known the elephant for years, always was well-behaved, and so thought it might be some disease. He was perfectly healthy according to the doctors, the elephant psychologist. There's nothing wrong with the elephant. And so in the story, a person who was going to be the Buddha in a future age just said, I will look after this, and I'll see if I can find out the reason why. So this fellow, instead of just testing out, you know, its blood samples and other things, he decided to stay next to the elephant's stall at night. So he stayed there all night, meditating, reading, or whatever. And then about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, he heard a sound behind the elephant stall, and he crept up silently to see what was going on. He found out there was a band of robbers, thieves, bad people. They'd meet there every evening to discuss what they'd stolen, who they were going to steal from next, what drugs to sell, how to get their debts back, who they're going to beat up, even who they're going to kill. There's a bad group of people who would always meet up there behind the elephant stall every evening. And of course, this minister he was in one of the governments knew exactly what was going on and why the elephant had become bad. Even though the elephant could not understand human language, could still understand the vibes, the bad energy coming from this group of bandits. So much so that over the weeks, the months, I don't know how long it went on for, the elephant had changed. So the next day, the minister had all those thieves arrested, and in their place, he invited the nuns and the monks to actually to go there and chant, this is what should be done, to meditate, to discuss the Dhamma, and to have... And because the monks and nuns were just so peaceful, so kind, always saying the right words, so much so that after a few days, the elephant started to get more back to its original, what it used to be like before, became just far more compliant and peaceful and happy. It would never squirt anyone or poo on anyone. It wouldn't even like fart, except when there's no one was around. Just check first of all, now I can do it. So it's a very well-behaved elephant, so much so that it became a very well-known story that even elephants, animals, they can pick up on the vibes of human beings. And if elephants and animals can do that, how much can human beings pick up on the good energies and vibes of good people? Which is one of the reasons why that sometimes people go and stay in monasteries for a week or 2 weeks, helping in the kitchen, meditating, doing any chores, or just staying there, having a peaceful time. And because they stay in a monastery with lots of monks, or stay in a monastery with lots of nuns, after a while they become very, very peaceful, these visitors. They get off on the monks' energies, And of course, the monks get very agitated because they get off on your energies. So, no, the monks and nuns have got a deeper store. We can take so much. But actually, that brings us up to the point, taking up so much. You know what it's like if ever you talk to somebody and they're in big trouble, or you try and help them, and you're a counsellor, or I don't know, that sometimes people go to temples and churches and stuff because they're in trouble and they really want to talk to you. And so sometimes you get so much negative input to you. So how do you deal with that? Great old Ajahn Chah was a genius. He said, yes, that's going to happen to you, when he talked to me before I came to Australia. He said, people are going to come up and they're going to unload all of their problems, their children, their marriage. I know you didn't get married. You want to avoid all of that, but you can't avoid it. People are going to dump their suffering onto you. So what do you do? And that's where he told this wonderful metaphor. That when somebody's in front of you, you're a monk or you're a nun, and they're talking all this rubbish about their boss at work, about their relationship, about their kids who won't do what they're told, who won't sort of clean up their rooms and never do their homework, and blah, 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 blah. Don't tell them I know what you're thinking. In other words, by saying, I became a monk to avoid all of that. So why are you dumping it onto me? He said, no, listen to them. Be a rubbish bin, he said, a trash can. Just an ordinary rubbish bin is sometimes not good enough. You know these big ones they have for the council they take every week? The big green bins. Imagine a big green receptacle of rubbish. And, he said, but make sure of one thing. When they unload the rubbish into you, take it. Just whatever you want to say. Oh, that's terrible. That's why. Oh, why did that happen to you? That's really unfair. Take it. But make sure, he said, the most important part of his teaching, make sure that there is a hole in the bottom of the rubbish bin. So it all goes through and you keep nothing. The rubbish bin with a hole in the bottom. What a wonderful thing that is. So they can dump as much rubbish in you as they wish, and you get up and you carry nothing with you. I thought that was really neat. And yeah, honestly, I'd do that. So in your interviews, I'd be listening, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. And then you come the next day, you say, remember what I talked about yesterday? I said, no. That way you can receive without keeping things. Now, that was because of great advice of Ajahn Chah. But anyway, just to working with your life and even some of the deeper teachings. I mean, where did all these ideas come from, and do they actually work? Do you have to decide to do them? Part of learning Buddhism is learning the psychology, how the mind works. And that was the story I'm just proceeding on to now, a little bit of deeper Buddhist psychology before I show how that you are manipulated, how you are conditioned, how you are brainwashed. But only good things. Of course, everyone would say that, but no, this is good things. You can always stop it if you wish. So there's lots of safety mechanisms there so you don't get exploited. So this was when I was with the monk who was senior to me. I was number two monk, and he was the senior monk. And I don't know what it is. Whenever you're senior, I tell the other monks this, and so I'm sure they do this to me. Fair enough. That, you know, when you're a boss in an office, or you're supposed to be the head of the family, if, you know, that's your tradition, they always have this idea. I remember this in Sri Lanka especially. Somebody told me this in Sri Lanka. Sort of, you know, single, married. In Sri Lanka, when you are married, it's like two individuals. Before they got married, the woman could go this way, the man could go that way. But once you're married, you're stuck together. You're like an elephant. One body, four legs. And because it's Asia, You know, in Asia, it's a very old tradition that the men have to be the front legs and the women have to be the back legs. I'm sorry, but just, you know, that's the culture. But in Sri Lanka anyway, and I'm sure the same in Singapore and many other places, Malaysia, in Singapore, Sri Lanka, many other countries, the front legs are always the man, the back legs are the woman. But in those countries, the elephant always walks backwards. But anyway, just going back to how I was number two and this other man was number one. So I didn't like walking backwards or walking frontwards, but sometimes I had some good ideas. And when you have a good idea, how frustrating is it? You know what it feels like? You tell your boss, why don't we do this? And no, it's a stupid idea, it won't work. They don't even think about it, they don't even consider it. It's because it's your idea, it must be wrong. So anyway, I found a way around that with this conditioning and brainwashing, who's actually in charge. So what I would do, well, this was the early years we were building huts, monks' huts in the forest. And so I would tell this monk, I said, why don't we build a hut just over there on that little hill? And he would say, no, no, it's a stupid idea, it just won't work. No, 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 no. I was wise enough not to argue. Don't argue, you'll spoil it. I said, okay, fair enough. And I go on talking about something else. And then 2 weeks later, when I thought he'd totally forgotten about the conversation, I'd say it again. You know, I think we need to build a hut. I think over there will be a very good place. And he'd forgotten what I said 2 weeks ago. He said, no, 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 it's a stupid idea, it just won't work. I don't know how many times this worked. It was just almost like reliable. And I'd be walking with him a couple of weeks later, and he said, I just had an idea. I think we should build a hut on the hill over there. And I said, wow, that's genius. I think that might work. I never told him it was my idea. Because I knew if you're a boss, it has to be your idea. I didn't care whether, you know, who actually owned the idea. I knew it was a good idea. I knew it came from me. But you know, I wanted to make sure that it got into his consciousness and he thought it was his idea, so he was in charge. You try that with your husband when you go back. So, darling, I think I need a new dress. Now you've got enough dresses. So, okay. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. Darling, I think I need a new dress. So, no, 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 no. It's just got too many. And they said, next day, it's your, close to your birthday, or Chinese New Year or something. And he comes up to you, said, darling, I think you need a new dress. And he buys you one. I know about this other guy, he wasn't so sensitive. It was a day before Valentine's Day. And he asked his wife, they'd been married a few years. He said, what would you like for Valentine's Day, darling? And she said, darling, I've got you. I don't need anything else. But they'd been married long enough that he knew that's not what she meant. He said, oh, come on, business is going well. I can get something special for you. So she looked him in the eye and realized, you know, they were, you know, reasonably well off. So she said to him, diamonds. Anything with diamonds in. And he smiled and said, okay, darling. And the following day, she opened her present, a little package, nicely wrapped with a nice bow, to darling, happy Valentine's Day. And when they opened, you know what was inside? It was a pack of playing cards. Well, you asked for something with diamonds. Okay, don't go there. Okay, back to, yeah. So it's amazing just how we can influence one another. And so I could get my huts built. but it had to be the boss's idea. So little by little, I wondered, why is that the case? Why do I have to influence others? And why am I influenced? And that is where I went back to some of the studies which I did and experiences which I had as a student at Cambridge. And one of those experiments which were done in front of, you know, the young men and some women, but mostly men, in this psychic research club. So we had a hypnotist, and the hypnotist would try and put some students under trance. I tried, but they couldn't get me under trance. I was quite willing to go under a trance, but you know, my mindfulness was too strong. So anyway, there's always one student they can put under trance, and then they get them to do all sorts of stupid things. You know, it's funny. But what was the thing I remember from that experience was this student was put under a trance, done many stupid things, but part of the demonstration was the hypnotist told him, in front of all of us watching, that when I touch my right earlobe, said the hypnotist, you will stand up, no matter what's going on, you will stand up and sing the British National Anthem from beginning to end in a loud voice. And you won't stop until you're finished. I thought, what a ridiculous thing that was. You know, that even then, if it was, they actually used to play the British anthem, National Anthem, after the movie was finished. But usually people would try and get out of the movie as the final credits came so they wouldn't have to stand. We weren't very nationalistic in Britain, especially as young students, especially hairy students with hippie beads. But nevertheless, this student, he was told to do this and said, you won't remember the instructions, but when I touch my right earlobe, that's what you'll do. And so I took him out of hypnosis. Then the hypnotist gave all these other demonstrations. And he knew how to perform, this hypnotist, because every now and again he'd move his hand up to his ear and then scratch his nose, just to get us excited, but eventually he touched his right earlobe. And this student stood up and started singing the British National Anthem, God Save the Queen, in a loud voice from beginning to end. And we thought it was the funniest thing on earth. We'd never seen anything, you know, so ridiculous. How would you, you know, sing a national anthem at this point of the proceedings? And we were laughing and kidding ourselves with laughter, and when he finished, he sat down, and the hypnotist said, please be quiet now. And he asked this young man, why did you choose to sing the British National Anthem? And this one was a university undergrad from Cambridge, so he was a smart fellow, and he gave this legitimate reason. He explained what appeared to be a valid reason why he did this. And that really shocked me. I and everyone else knew he never chose to sing the national anthem. It was programmed into him by the hypnotist. It was one of the most stupid things to do. But to him, because he did it, he found a reason, a valid reason. And he was convinced. To him, it was really obvious that he had freely chosen to do that. That made me very scared. How much of what I've done in my life do I think is my own free will? And how much just appears to be free will, but it's totally conditioned? Sadhu, sadhu. What are you doing that for? We haven't finished the talk yet. You see, I've proven the point. How susceptible are we? So from that, I mean, are you really in charge? Who's in charge? And that's where He started again through science, and I'm going on to science now rather than Dhamma, going into meditation a few moments, that there was this Professor John Libet, L-I-B-E-T. He did some really great experiments on the nature of the human will. He wanted to find out, is there such a thing as free will, and what is it? Using very simple experiments. So what John Libet did, you can look him up on the internet, it's very clear. L-I-B-E-T. What he did was he had a load of students doing this part of this experiment. You had your hand, you could clench your fist, open your fist, clench it, open it, whenever you decided to. But when you decide to clench your fist, you press a button. When you open it, you press another button with the other hand. And very, very careful, making sure reaction times, every other times, to make sure that you could actually pretty much say when a person decided to flex a wrist and when they did it. And of course, it's something like a half a second between deciding and flexing the wrist. But at the same time, he had some gizmos, electric measuring devices on the brain, and found out before you decided, there was what they call like the readiness potential. That's what he called it, readiness potential in the brain. And after the readiness potential, maybe another half a second or whatever, after the readiness potential, then you decided, then you moved. What he proved conclusively, I'm just describing it, if you read the scientific papers, way more carefully argued, but no one has ever managed to debunk what he found, that what you can be aware of is what decides your actions and speech. What we call our will is not what starts the process. The process has already been initiated. It's already started. You can measure that in the brain. And once the brain is lit up, short time later, half a second or something, some around about that time, then you are aware of this thing called will. Then the movement happens. The will is not what starts things happening. By the time you're aware of the will, the process has already begun. Because you're not aware of that starting mechanism, you're only aware of what happens next, this phenomena which we call will. We assume that the will started all of this. But it didn't. And if you keep looking at experiments like that, that starts to show you that we assume we can be aware of it, this thing called the will, but it's not what starts everything. It started beforehand. And now you probably understand why. Apparently in advertising, just as a general rule, that advertising, every dollar spent in advertising usually makes you $3 in profits. It's a very lucrative business to advertise things. Obviously, some adverts don't work, other adverts really are tremendous, but it certainly, it influences you enormously. So when you go to the shops to buy some milk, what milk do you buy? When you buy a flight or a train to go back to your home, which one do you buy? Why? What food do you eat? What glasses do you wear? What clothes? Do you freely choose what's the beautiful clothes? Or has somebody already convinced you that that's beautiful? So these are very challenging questions. And this is what the science says. But then you go and watch how your mind works. Because what happens? You may have noticed that in all of these meditations, I don't tell you what to do. The advice is to stop doing things, not to make a jhana happen, but to sit there, nothing doing, not choosing, not willing, but calming the will down until the will is not working, until you are what we call peaceful. How can you be peaceful and have a will there? Come on, be peaceful. That's not peaceful enough. Now maybe you've got to do this and then we can become peaceful later on. And maybe we should do... All of that noise is coming from the thing we call the will, you. And sometimes people say, look, I'm just trying to be quiet. Well, don't try to be quiet. You don't have to try to be peaceful. You stop the trying, and then peace happens. Remember what I said about the cup of water? How do I keep the cup of water be perfectly still? You put it down. And then it becomes still. You think it's still now? Is the water still inside there? Give it a while. Is it still now? Kanchana, do you want to come and check? Is my water still in here? Come and check. Get your glasses on. Is it still? So what's the answer? Is it still or is it not? Come on.
There's nothing in there. Wow. That's deep. You can go sit down now. Thank you. So, sometimes we make all these assumptions. We've got to have a look. Is there anything in there? Is there a will there anyway? So little by little we get so still and peaceful. We're not doing anything. You really are. It's one of the hardest things to teach. So sometimes we have to trick people into doing this. Trick you into just sitting there doing absolutely nothing. But I'll fall asleep. Fall asleep. Relax. And after a while you've slept enough, and then you're sitting there, you're not doing anything. And it's so beautiful when you're not doing anything, not deciding to get jhanas, get enlightenment, or become a bodhisattva, or become the next Jesus, or just become, I don't know what you want to become, or get sort of, abducted by aliens. Any aliens around, please abduct me, I'm getting bored on this retreat. Whatever it is, you have such a complicated life, doing all sorts of stuff, and writing your biography, and just, oh, this is an amazing retreat, I've got to write about it afterwards. And then you say, no, I better not write about it, and you're doing so much work, and thinking backwards and forwards, you're not meditating at all. But imagine, you stop. Just like that little novice. Stop. And the pauses between movements get longer and longer and longer. If you want to try that, I haven't had too much success. I should have lots of success with it. But you know, you use a little mantra. And you can use Om Mani Padme Hum if you like, or Namo Tassa or whatever. So, or even the quite a beautiful in Indonesia. Any Indonesians here from Indonesia? Oh, yeah, okay, good. You know that we usually say hello to each other, Namo Buddhaya, in the Theravada way. It's a beautiful way, Namo Buddhaya. So you can use that word, which means like homage to the Buddha. So you can use that word, Namo Buddhaya. Namo Buddhaya. Five syllables. So you chant that to yourself quietly. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya. Just to actually to push all the thoughts away. And then, stage two, you put a space between the syllables. Na, mo, bud, da, ya, na, mo, bud. About the same length as the syllable itself. So however long na is, then the space afterwards. Na, mo, bud, da. Yeah, you don't rush it. And then lengthen the space. Maybe two syllables time between each syllable. Na, mo, bud. And if a thought comes up in that gap, close it down. So a little bit, you extend the gaps until it gets very long. Na, mo, bud, da, ya. And if you want those gaps to get very long, you can't will them, control them, hold them, or try and stop thoughts coming in. Every time you do something, every time you will, you create thoughts. So if you just relax, let go, stop, renounce, and feel just so happy, just allowing the silence to be, then it gets very long. Now, you don't keep the silence. You let it last. You let it happen. It's the default state. It's natural. It's what happens when you don't do anything. So, when we get the idea, it's not something you do. It's not something you make happen. You renounce. You let it go. You stop. You make peace. You just sit there. And silence comes. It's just there. It's the default state. Nothing else is happening. Then you find when the will starts to get less and less and less, it gets so much more peaceful. But there's a problem there. You know what the problem is? Is because when you are silent, it's as if you don't exist. Sometimes we have to check. Am I still there? Oh yeah, I'm still there. This is true. The association with will and doing and with your essential sense of existence is so strong that once the will starts to disappear, it's as if you don't exist. You're not there. Still aware and mindful, is having a wonderful time. But your thoughts, concepts, designations of who you think you are disappearing. Being and doing are so connected. So what happens is that, oh my goodness, I saw this in Cambridge. They used to have graffiti, but it was such brilliant graffiti. You know, it wasn't just somebody's name or just some squiggle on the wall. It was something which really had meaning. And this was one of my favorite pieces of graffiti. It was outside written. I saw it myself, these eyes. It was written on the walls of the philosophy department in Cambridge. And it started off with the French philosopher Descartes, René Descartes, which said it's... sometimes I get this the wrong way around, but anyway. He said is... to do is to be. René Descartes, 17th century or something. And then underneath that was a refutation by Jean-Paul Sartre of last century. Not to do is to be, but to be is to do. And then underneath that, it was all summed up by a modern American philosopher. He'd only just died in about 10, 15 years ago. Doobie doobie doo, Frank Sinatra. But the whole thing was making a connection between doing and being.
If you stop doing things, you stop being. Many of you, at least some, yes, quite a few of you like me, are getting old. You're getting close to retirement. If you don't do anything, it's like you don't exist. People come and ask you, what do you do in life? Nothing. They can't understand that. They can't understand if you go and sit over on the benches outside or the chairs outside the dining room and just watch the trees grow. You can't watch trees grow. That's just like a myth, is it? I don't know. Maybe I haven't sat there long enough. You try it. Are those of you sitting out there, have you seen any trees grow yet? Doesn't mean it's just an excuse to do nothing. Because if you say, I'm doing nothing, if you tell your wife or your husband, you know, you're sitting down there, so what are you doing today, darling? Nothing. And then they give you a job to do. So you say, I'm just watching the trees grow, or contemplating the nature of dependent origination or the five components of existence or whatever. Make something up. But it actually feels a bit difficult. Because when you don't do anything for long periods of time, it's as if you have no meaning. In the term, the Western world idea of the word meaning, but you're so happy and so peaceful. Having a wonderful time just being there. Not doing anything. Not going anywhere. The whole world, or rather the world by which you define your existence, starts to vanish. And you realize that this is far more true than all this doing business. And then, when you sit down meditation, how do you meditate? You just don't do anything. Oh, come on, Ajahn Brahm, yeah. You've got to do something. You've got to watch the breath, watch the nimitta, watch... what am I supposed to watch? This. What do you mean this? Yeah, this. After a while, people get it. They're just sitting and close their eyes. Whatever's in front of the mind right now, the most important thing in the world, of course it is. Now is the only time you have, that's obvious. The only thing to do is to care, which is natural. You know, if people weren't so tired and rushing around, they'd be far more kind in this world. If we can just slow people down, the kindness would improve. It's just nature. So after a while, you're just sitting there, just this is the most important thing in the world. You're not doing anything with it. Caring, opening the door of your heart no matter what's happening. It's beautiful. It's you're caring for it. You're not trying to get rid of it. You're not trying to change it. You're not trying to cure it. You're not trying to improve it. You're just being with it. And after a while, everything gets so quiet and still. And that's where you're sitting there in the Zen monastery watching a wall, the wall vanishes. Wow. You're sitting there just with your eyes closed and your body vanishes. And you're not worried. You're watching there and your breath vanishes. You're watching there and this beautiful lights appear. And they're gorgeous. You can't will them because they're wonderful teachers, nimittas. If you try and grab hold of them and use your will to overpower them, they just vanish. The only way they can really stay, the real ones, the beautiful ones, is just leaving them alone, stopping. They just come to you. Just like the carrot came to the donkey. You're just sitting there, just watching all of this. Not making any decisions. That's part of doing. And then this body of yours vanishes. And all this mind, its will, vanishes. That's what happens in the second jhana. I think I mentioned this to somebody. That's what really stands out. In that, you just, there's no will left. It's gone. How does that feel like? Can I explain it? You try explaining dry land to a fish. We just can't understand what you're talking about. Tadpole can understand because it becomes a frog. So little by little, we can understand what's going on by experience. When you stand on dry land, totally different than anything you've experienced since you were born. Really weird, but beautiful. And you understand what it's like to the body to vanish. We all know the body's not ours. You know, boy, girl, Ang Mo, Kwai Lo, whatever, that's what I'm supposed to be. But so what? It's so superficial, so external. So you go inside, you're not your body, you're not your will. Well, isn't that great? And I know exactly where my will comes from. Why I tell bad jokes? It's obvious, and Ajahn Sujato saw through that. He said, the only reason you tell bad jokes is because your father told bad jokes. I just picked it up from him. Because I was conditioned, brainwashed by him to tell bad jokes. Just like the one he'd often say, he said that he came home, one of his friends at work, he got hit by a bus. They took him to hospital and they had to amputate one of his legs. Well, unfortunately, this was quite a while ago, 50 years ago, under stress, they amputated the wrong leg. So they had to put him almost straight back into the hospital again. He had to have the bad leg amputated. I've heard stories like this. It happens. And then once he was, well enough, that he got a lawyer and he sued the hospital. But he lost his case. He didn't have a leg to stand on. And I remember my father telling me that joke. Oh, you... I believed you. So that's where I get my bad sense of humor from. So I take no responsibility. I totally blame my father. Any wisdom, I take no praise for. That all came from Ajahn Chah. So I've got nothing which I'm responsible for. Isn't that really cool? Tell a bad joke, I'll just blame my dad. Get praise because I give a good talk, that's just Ajahn Chah. Totally free. So that means when you're free from praise and blame, how does that feel? Imagine it. You do what needs to be done, whatever that is. People praise you, blame you. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. So anyway, over the last it's a week now, isn't it? Almost a week, 6 days that I've been brainwashing you how to meditate. And of course, if it works, it'll be reinforced. If it doesn't work, you just let it go. And other things about the nature of the will, the nature of bliss, the nature of peace, freedom, forgiveness, kindness, all of those wonderful reflections. And I thought when Ajahn Chah was brainwashing me, I thought, that was just too deep for me, or that was ridiculous. That must be some Thai idea. I just don't understand it. You know, I always thought I'd reject all those teachings which Ajahn Chah gave, which I couldn't understand, which made no sense. I thought, no, that's not for me. 45 years later, you look back and they found a place in my memory somewhere and they stood there, just like those seeds in the middle of the desert. They're there and they do nothing for years and years and years. And then suddenly there's a rainstorm and all those seeds, they start blossoming. They germinate and blossom. It's this mat of beautiful flowers in the desert. The seeds were planted, just waiting for a little bit of water to germinate them, just like the wisdom which you've been hearing, which I heard, which you'll hear from many sources. Eventually, the rain comes, nice meditation, and all those things will germinate. Ah, that's how it works. And it's nothing to do with you. Don't praise yourself, there's no one there to praise. Don't blame yourself when it all goes wrong, not your fault. It's wonderful when you can pass the buck. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, I don't know how deep that was, but anyway, that's all I could do. The nature of the will. Da, da, da.